could tell no one. Septimus has been working too hard. That was all she could say to her own mother. To love makes one solitary, she thought. She could tell nobody, not even Septimus now. And looking back, she saw him sitting in his shabby overcoat, alone, on the seat, hunched up, staring. And it was cowardly for a man to say he would kill himself. But Septimus had fought. He was brave. He was not Septimus now. She put on her lace collar. She put on her new hat, and he never noticed. And he was happy without her. Nothing could make her happy without him. Nothing. He was selfish. So men are. For he was not ill. Dr. Holmes said there was nothing the matter with him. She spread her hand before her. Look. Her wedding ring slipped. She had grown so thin. It was she who suffered, but she had nobody to tell. Far was Italy, and the white houses, and the room where her sisters sat making hats, and the streets crowded every evening with people walking, laughing out loud, not half alive like people here, huddled up in bath chairs, looking at a few ugly flowers stuck in pots. "For you should see the Milan gardens," she said aloud. But to whom? There was nobody. Her words faded. So a rocket fades. Its sparks, having grazed their way into the night, surrender to it. Dark descends, pours over the outlines of houses and towers. Bleak hillsides soften and fall in. But though they are gone, the night is full of them. Robbed of colour, blank of windows, they exist more ponderously, give out what the frank daylight fails to transmit. The trouble and suspense of things conglomerated there in the darkness, huddled together in the darkness. Reft of the relief which dawn brings when, washing the walls white and grey, spotting each window pane, lifting the mist from the fields, showing the red-brown cows peacefully grazing, all is once more decked out to the eye, exists again. As a cloud crosses the sun, silence falls on London, and falls on the mind. Effort ceases, time flaps on the mast. There we stop, there we stand. Rigid, the skeleton of habit alone upholds the human frame. Where there is nothing, Peter Walsh said to himself, feeling hollowed out, utterly empty within. Clarissa refused me, he thought. He stood there, thinking, Clarissa refused me. Ah, said St. Margaret's, like a hostess who comes into her drawing-room on the very stroke of the hour and finds her guests there already. I am not late. No. It is precisely 11:30, she says. Yet, though she is perfectly right, her voice, being the voice of the hostess, is reluctant to inflict its individuality. Some grief for the past holds it back, some concern for the present. It is 11:30, she says, and the sound of St. Margaret's glides into the recesses of the heart and buries itself in ring after ring of sound, like something alive which wants to confide itself, to disperse itself, to be, with a tremor of delight, at rest. Like Clarissa herself, thought Peter Walsh, coming down the stairs on the stroke of the hour in white. It is Clarissa herself, he thought, with a deep emotion, and an extraordinarily clear, yet puzzling, recollection of her. As if this bell had come into the room years ago, where they sat at some moment of great intimacy, and had gone from one to the other, and had left, like a bee with honey, laden with the moment. But what room? What moment? And why had he been so profoundly happy when the clock was striking? Then, as the sound of St. Margaret's languished, he thought, she's been ill, and the sound expressed languor and suffering. It was her heart, he remembered, and the sudden loudness of the final stroke tolled for death that surprised in the midst of life, Clarissa falling where she stood in her drawing-room. "No, no," he cried, "she's not dead. I am not old," he cried, and marched up Whitehall as if there rolled down to him, vigorous, unending, his future. He was not old, or set, or dried in the least. As for caring what they said of him, the Dalloways, the Whitbreads and their set, he cared not a straw. Though it was true he would have some time or other to see whether Richard couldn't help him to some job. Striding, staring, he glared at the statue of the Duke of Cambridge. He had been sent down from Oxford. True. He had been a socialist, in some sense a failure. True. Still, the future of civilization lies, he thought, in the hands of young men like that. Of young men such as he was 30 years ago, with their love of abstract principles, getting books sent out to them all the way from London to a peak in the Himalayas, reading science, reading philosophy. The future lies in the hands of young men like that, he thought. And of course she enjoyed life immensely. It was her nature to enjoy, though goodness only knows she had her reserves. It was a mere sketch, he often felt, that even he, after all these years, could make of Clarissa. Anyhow, there was no bitterness in her, none of that sense of moral virtue which is so repulsive in good women. She enjoyed practically everything. If you walked with her in Hyde Park, now it was a bed of tulips, now a child in a perambulator, now some absurd little drama she made up on the spur of the moment. Very likely she would have talked to those lovers if she had thought them unhappy. She had a sense of comedy that was really exquisite. But she needed people, always people, to bring it out, with the inevitable result that she frittered her time away, lunching, dining, giving these incessant parties of hers, talking nonsense, saying things she didn't mean, blunting the edge of her mind, losing her discrimination. There she would sit at the head of the table, taking infinite pains with some old buffer who might be useful to Dalloway. They knew the most appalling bores in Europe. Or in came Elizabeth, and everything must give way to her. She was at a high school, at the inarticulate stage, last time he was over. A round-eyed, pale-faced girl, with nothing of her mother in her, a silent, stolid creature, who took it all as a matter of course, let her mother make a fuss of her, and then said, "May I go now?" like a child of four. Going off, Clarissa explained, with that mixture of amusement and pride which Dalloway himself seemed to rouse in her, to play hockey. And now Elizabeth was out, presumably, thought him an old fogey, laughed at her mother's friends. Ah, well, so be it. The compensation of growing old, Peter Walsh thought, coming out of Regent's Park and holding his hat in hand, was simply this: that the passions remain as strong as ever, but one has gained, at last, the power which adds the supreme flavour to existence, the power of taking hold of experience, of turning it round slowly in the light. A terrible confession it was, he put his hat on again, but now, at the age of 53, one scarcely needed people any more. Life itself, every moment of it, every drop of it, here, this instant, now, in the sun, in Regent's Park, was enough. Too much, indeed. A whole lifetime was too short to bring out, now that one had acquired the power, the full flavour, to extract every ounce of pleasure, every shade of meaning, which both were so much more solid than they used to be, so much less personal. It was impossible that he should ever suffer again as Clarissa had made him suffer. For hours at a time, pray God that one might say these things without being overheard, for hours and days he never thought of Daisy. Could it be that he was in love with her then, remembering the misery, the torture, the extraordinary passion of those days? It was a different thing altogether, a much pleasanter thing, the truth being, of course, that now she was in love with him. And that, perhaps, was the reason why, when the ship actually sailed, he felt an extraordinary relief, wanted nothing so much as to be alone, was annoyed to find all her little attentions, cigars, notes, a rug for the voyage, in his cabin. Everyone, if they were honest, would say the same. One doesn't want people after 50. One doesn't want to go on telling women they are pretty. That's what most men of 50 would say, Peter Walsh thought, if they were honest. "How's Clarissa?" she asked abruptly. Clarissa always said that Lady Bruton didn't like her. Indeed, Lady Bruton had the reputation of being more interested in politics than people, of talking like a man, of having had a finger in some notorious intrigue of the 80s, which was now beginning to be mentioned in memoirs. Certainly, there was an alcove in her drawing room, and a table in that alcove, and a photograph upon that table of General Sir Talbot Moore, now deceased, who had written there one evening in the 80s, in Lady Bruton's presence, with her cognizance, perhaps advice, a telegram ordering the British troops to advance upon an historical occasion. She kept the pen and told the story. Thus, when she said in her offhand way, "How's Clarissa?" husbands had difficulty in persuading their wives, and indeed, however devoted, were secretly doubtful themselves of her interest in women who often got in their husbands' way, prevented them from accepting posts abroad, and had to be taken to the seaside in the middle of the session to recover from influenza. Nevertheless, her inquiry, "How's Clarissa?" was known by women infallibly to be a signal from a well-wisher, from an almost silent companion, whose utterances, half a dozen perhaps in the course of a lifetime, signified recognition of some feminine comradeship which went beneath masculine lunch parties, and united Lady Bruton and Mrs. Dalloway, who seldom met and appeared when they did meet indifferent and even hostile, in a singular bond. "I met Clarissa in the park this morning," said Hugh Whitbread, diving into the casserole, anxious to pay himself this little tribute, for he had only to come to London, and he met everybody at once. "But greedy, one of the greediest men she had ever known," Milly Brush thought, who observed men with unflinching rectitude, and was capable of everlasting devotion, to her own sex in particular, being knobbed, scraped, angular, and entirely without feminine charm. "Do you know who's in town?" said Lady Bruton, suddenly bethinking her. "Our old friend Peter Walsh." They all smiled. Peter Walsh. And Mr. Dalloway was genuinely glad, Milly Brush thought. And Mr. Whitbread thought only of his chicken. Peter Walsh. All three, Lady Bruton, Hugh Whitbread, and Richard Dalloway, remembered the same thing. How passionately Peter had been in love, been rejected, gone to India, come a cropper, made a mess of things. And Richard Dalloway had a very great liking for the dear old fellow, too. Milly Brush saw that, saw a depth in the brown of his eyes, saw him hesitate, consider, which interested her, as Mr. Dalloway always interested her, for what was he thinking, she wondered, about Peter Walsh? That Peter Walsh had been in love with Clarissa, that he would go back directly after lunch and find Clarissa, that he would tell her, in so many words, that he loved her. Yes, he would say that. It was not that he said anything, for being solitary he could only address himself to the waiter. It was his way of looking at the menu, of pointing his forefinger to a particular wine, of hitching himself up to the table, of addressing himself seriously, not gluttonously, to dinner, that won him their respect. which, having to remain unexpressed for the greater part of the meal, flared up at the table where the Morrises sat, when Mr. Walsh was heard to say at the end of the meal, "Bartlett pears." Why he should have spoken so moderately, yet firmly, with the air of a disciplinarian well within his rights, which are founded upon justice, neither young Charles Morris nor old Charles, neither Miss Elaine nor Mrs. Morris, knew. But when he said, "Bartlett pears," sitting alone at his table, they felt that he counted on their support in some lawful demand, was champion of a cause which immediately became their own, so that their eyes met his eyes sympathetically, and when they all reached the smoking-room simultaneously, a little talk between them became inevitable. It was not very profound, only to the effect that London was crowded, had changed in 30 years, that Mr. Morris preferred Liverpool, that Mrs. Morris had been to the Westminster Flower Show, and that they had all seen the Prince of Wales. Yet, thought Peter Walsh, no family in the world can compare with the Morrises, none whatever, and their relations to each other are perfect, and they don't care a hang for the upper classes, and they like what they like, and Elaine is training for the family business, and the boy has won a scholarship at Leeds, and the old lady, who is about his own age, has 3 more children at home, and they have 2 motor cars, but Mr. Morris still mends the boots on Sunday. It is superb, it is absolutely superb, thought Peter Walsh, swaying a little backwards and forwards with his liqueur glass in his hand among the hairy red chairs and ashtrays, feeling very pleased with himself, for the Morrises liked him. Yes, they liked a man who said, "Bartlett pears." They liked him, he felt. He would go to Clarissa's party. The Morrises moved off, but they would meet again. He would go to Clarissa's party because he wanted to ask Richard what they were doing in India, the conservative duffers, and what's being acted, and music. Oh yes, and mere gossip. For this is the truth about our soul, he thought, our self, who fish-like inhabits deep seas and plies among obscurities, threading her way between the boles of giant weeds, over sun-flickered spaces and on into gloom, cold, deep, inscrutable. Suddenly she shoots to the surface and sports on the wind-wrinkled waves. That is, has a positive need to brush, scrape, kindle herself, gossiping. What did the government mean, Richard Dalloway would know, to do about India? "But where is Clarissa?" said Peter. He was sitting on the sofa with Sally. After all these years, he really couldn't call her Lady Rossiter. "Where's the woman gone to?" he asked. "Where's Clarissa?" Sally supposed, and so did Peter, for the matter of that, that there were people of importance, politicians, whom neither of them knew unless by sight in the picture papers, whom Clarissa had to be nice to, had to talk to, as she was with them. Yet there was Richard Dalloway, not in the cabinet. He hadn't been a success, Sally supposed. For herself, she scarcely ever read the papers. She sometimes saw his name mentioned, but then, well, she lived a very solitary life, in the wilds, Clarissa would say, among great merchants, great manufacturers, men, after all, who did things. She had done things too. "I have 5 sons, she told him. Lord, Lord, what a change had come over her. The softness of motherhood, its egotism too. Last time they met, Peter remembered, had been among the cauliflowers in the moonlight. The leaves, like rough bronze, she had said, with her literary turn. And she had picked a rose. She had marched him up and down that awful night, after the scene by the fountain. He was to catch the midnight train. Heavens, he had wept. That was his old trick, opening a pocket knife, thought Sally, always opening and shutting a knife when he got excited. They had been very, very intimate, she and Peter Walsh, when he was in love with Clarissa. And there was that dreadful, ridiculous scene over Richard Dalloway at lunch. She had called Richard Wickham. Why not call Richard Wickham? Clarissa had flared up, and indeed, they'd never seen each other since, she and Clarissa. Not more than half a dozen times, perhaps, in the last 10 years. And Peter Walsh had gone off to India, and she'd heard vaguely that he had made an unhappy marriage, and she didn't know whether he had any children, and she couldn't ask him, for he had changed. He was rather shrivelled-looking, but kinder, she felt, and she had a real affection for him, for he was connected with her youth, and she still had a little Emily Bronte he had given her, and he was to write, surely. In those days he was to write. "Have you written?" she asked him, spreading her hand, her firm and shapely hand, on her knee in a way he recalled. "Not a word," said Peter Walsh, and she laughed. She was still attractive, still a personage, Sally Seaton. But who was this Rossiter? He wore 2 camellias on his wedding day. That was all Peter knew of him. They had myriads of servants, miles of conservatories, Clarissa wrote. Something like that. Sally owned it with a shout of laughter. "Yes, I have 10,000 a year." Whether before the tax was paid or after, she couldn't remember. For her husband, "whom you must meet," she said, "whom you would like," she said, did all that for her. And Sally used to be in rags and tatters. She had pawned her grandmother's ring, which Marie Antoinette had given her great-grandfather, to come to Boughton. Oh, yes, Sally remembered. She had it still, a ruby ring which Marie Antoinette had given her great-grandfather. She never had a penny to her name in those days, and going to Boughton always meant some frightful pinch. But going to Boughton had meant so much to her, had kept her sane, she believed, so unhappy had she been at home. But that was all a thing of the past, all over now, she said, and Mr. Parry was dead. And Miss Parry was still alive. Never had he had such a shock in his life, said Peter. He'd been quite certain she was dead. And the marriage had been, Sally supposed, a success. And that very handsome, very self-possessed young woman was Elizabeth, over there, by the curtains, in red. She was like a poplar. She was like a river. She was like a hyacinth, Willie Titcomb was thinking. Oh, how much nicer to be in the country and do what she liked. She could hear her poor dog howling, Elizabeth was certain. She was not a bit like Clarissa, Peter Walsh said. Oh, Clarissa, said Sally. I am alone, I am alone, she cried, by the fountain in Regent's Park, staring at the Indian and his cross. As perhaps at midnight, when all boundaries are lost, the country reverts to its ancient shape, as the Romans saw it, lying cloudy when they landed, and the hills had no names, and rivers wound they knew not where. Such was her darkness, when suddenly, as if a shelf were shot forth and she stood on it, she said how she was his wife, married years ago in Milan, his wife, and would never, never tell that he was mad. Turning, the shelf fell. Down, down, she dropped. For he was gone, she thought. Gone, as he threatened, to kill himself, to throw himself under a cart. But no, there he was, still sitting alone on the seat, in his shabby overcoat, his legs crossed, staring, talking aloud. Men must not cut down trees. There is a God. He noted such revelations on the backs of envelopes. Change the world. No one kills from hatred. Make it known. He wrote it down. He waited. He listened. A sparrow perched on the railing opposite chirped, Septimus, Septimus, 4 or 5 times over, and went on, drawing its notes out, to sing freshly and piercingly in Greek words how there is no crime, and, joined by another sparrow, they sang in voices prolonged and piercing in Greek words from trees in the meadow of life beyond a river where the dead walk, how there is no death. there was his hand. There, the dead. White things were assembling behind the railings opposite, but he dared not look. Evans was behind the railings. "What are you saying?" said Raizia suddenly, sitting down by him. Interrupted again. She was always interrupting. "Away from people. They must get away from people," he said, jumping up. "Right away over there, where there were chairs beneath a tree and the long slope of the park dipped like a length of green stuff with a ceiling cloth of blue and pink smoke high above. And there was a rampart of far irregular houses hazed in smoke. The traffic hummed in a circle. And on the right, dun-coloured animals stretched long necks over the zoo palings, barking, howling. There they sat down under a tree. "Look," she implored him, pointing at a little troop of boys carrying cricket stumps, and one shuffled, spun round on his heel and shuffled, as if he were acting a clown at the music hall. "Look," she implored him, for Dr. Holmes had told her to make him notice real things. Go to a music hall, play cricket. That was the very game, Dr. Holmes said, a nice out-of-door game, the very game for her husband. "Look," she repeated. "Look," the unseen bade him, the voice which now communicated with him who was the greatest of mankind, Septimus, lately taken from life to death, the Lord who had come to renew society, who lay like a coverlet, a snow blanket smitten only by the sun, forever unwasted, suffering forever, the scapegoat, the eternal sufferer. But he didn't want it, he moaned, putting from him with a wave of his hand that eternal suffering, that eternal loneliness. "Look," she repeated, for he must not talk aloud to himself out of doors. "Oh, look," she implored him. But what was there to look at? A few sheep. That was all. A patter like the patter of leaves in a wood came from behind, and with it a rustling, regular thudding sound, which, as it overtook him, drummed his thoughts, strict in step, up Whitehall without his doing. Boys in uniform, carrying guns, marched with their eyes ahead of them, marched, their arms stiff, and on their faces an expression like the letters of a legend written round the base of a statue, praising duty, gratitude, fidelity, love of England. It is, thought Peter Walsh, beginning to keep step with them, a very fine training. But they didn't look robust. They were weedy, for the most part, boys of 16 who might tomorrow stand behind bowls of rice, cakes of soap on counters. Now they wore on them, unmixed with sensual pleasure or daily preoccupations, the solemnity of the wreath which they had fetched from Finsbury pavement to the empty tomb. They had taken their vow. The traffic respected it. Vans were stopped. "I can't keep up with them," Peter Walsh thought, as they marched up Whitehall. And sure enough, on they marched, past him, past everyone, in their steady way, as if one will worked legs and arms uniformly, and life, with its varieties, its irreticences, had been laid under a pavement of monuments and wreaths and drugged into a stiff yet staring corpse by discipline. One had to respect it. One might laugh, but one had to respect it, he thought. There they go, thought Peter Walsh, pausing at the edge of the pavement. And all the exalted statues, Nelson, Gordon, Havelock, the black, the spectacular images of great soldiers, stood looking ahead of them, as if they too had made the same renunciation. Peter Walsh felt he too had made it, the great renunciation, trampled under the same temptations, and achieved at length a marble stair. But the stair Peter Walsh did not want for himself in the least, though he could respect it in others. He could respect it in boys. They don't know the troubles of the flesh yet, he thought, as the marching boys disappeared in the direction of the Strand. All that I've been through, he thought, crossing the road and standing under Gordon's statue. Gordon, whom as a boy he had worshipped. Gordon standing lonely with one leg raised and his arms crossed. Poor Gordon, he thought. And just because nobody yet knew he was in London, except Clarissa, and the earth, after the voyage, still seemed an island to him, the strangeness of standing alone, alive, unknown, at 11:30 in Trafalgar Square, overcame him. What is it? Where am I? And why, after all, does one do it, he thought, the divorce seeming all moonshine. And down his mind went, flat as a marsh, and three great emotions bowled over him. Understanding, a vast philanthropy, and finally, as if the result of the others, an irrepressible, exquisite delight. As if inside his brain, by another hand, strings were pulled, shutters moved, and he, having nothing to do with it, yet stood at the opening of endless avenues down which, if he chose, he might wander. He hadn't felt so young for years. He had escaped, was utterly free. As happens in the downfall of habit, when the mind, like an unguarded flame, bows and bends and seems about to blow from its holding. I haven't felt so young for years, thought Peter, escaping, only of course for an hour or so, from being precisely what he was, and feeling like a child who runs out of doors and sees, as he runs, his old nurse waving at the wrong window. But she is extraordinarily attractive, he thought, as, walking across Trafalgar Square in the direction of the Haymarket, came a young woman who, as she passed Gordon's statue, seemed, Peter Walsh thought, susceptible as he was, to shed veil after veil until she became the very woman he had always had in mind. Young, but stately. Merry, but discreet. Black, but enchanting. But then these astonishing accesses of emotion. Bursting into tears this morning, what was all that about? What could Clarissa have thought of him? Thought him a fool, presumably, not for the first time. It was jealousy that was at the bottom of it. Jealousy which survives every other passion of mankind, Peter Walsh thought, holding his pocket knife at arm's length. She had been meeting Major Ord, Daisy said in her last letter. Said it on purpose, he knew. Said it to make him jealous. He could see her wrinkling her forehead as she wrote, wondering what she could say to hurt him. And yet it made no difference. He was furious. All this pother of coming to England and seeing lawyers wasn't to marry her, but to prevent her from marrying anybody else. That was what tortured him. That was what came over him when he saw Clarissa, so calm, so cold, so intent on her dress or whatever it was. Realising what she might have spared him, what she had reduced him to, a whimpering, snivelling old ass. But women, he thought, shutting his pocket knife, don't know what passion is. They don't know the meaning of it to men. Clarissa was as cold as an icicle. There she would sit on the sofa by his side, let him take her hand, give him one kiss. Here he was at the crossing. A sound interrupted him. A frail, quivering sound, a voice bubbling up without direction, vigour, beginning or end, running weakly and shrilly and with an absence of all human meaning into Ium faum so fu sui tuimu. The voice of no age or sex, the voice of an ancient spring spouting from the earth, which issued just opposite Regent's Park tube station from a tall, quivering shape, like a funnel, like a rusty pump, like a wind-beaten tree forever barren of leaves, which lets the wind run up and down its branches, singing Ium faum so fu sui tuimu, and rocks and creaks and moans in the eternal breeze. Through all ages, when the pavement was grass, when it was swamp, through the age of tusk and mammoth, through the age of silent sunrise. The battered woman, for she wore a skirt, with her right hand exposed, her left clutching at her side, stood singing of love. Love which has lasted a million years, she sang, love which prevails. And millions of years ago, her lover, who had been dead these centuries, had walked, she crooned, with her in May. But in the course of ages, long as summer days, and flaming, she remembered, with nothing but red asters, he had gone. Death's enormous sickle had swept those tremendous hills, and when at last she laid her hoary and immensely aged head on the earth, now become a mere cinder of ice, she implored the gods to lay by her side a bunch of purple heather, there on her high burial place, which the last rays of the last sun caressed, for then the pageant of the universe would be over. Millie Brush once might almost have fallen in love with these silences. And Mr. Dalloway was always so dependable, such a gentleman, too. Now, being 40, Lady Bruton had only to nod or turn her head a little abruptly, and Millie Brush took the signal, however deeply she might be sunk in these reflections of a detached spirit, of an uncorrupted soul whom life could not bamboozle, because life had not offered her a trinket of the slightest value. Not a curl, smile, lip, cheek, nose, nothing whatever. Lady Bruton had only to nod, and Perkins was instructed to quicken the coffee. "Yes, Peter Walsh has come back," said Lady Bruton. It was vaguely flattering to them all. He had come back, battered, unsuccessful, to their secure shores. But to help him, they reflected, was impossible. There was some flaw in his character. Hugh Whitbread said one might, of course, mention his name to so-and-so. He wrinkled lugubriously, consequentially, at the thought of the letters he would write to the heads of government offices about my old friend Peter Walsh, and so on. But it wouldn't lead to anything, not to anything permanent, because of his character. "In trouble with some woman," said Lady Bruton. They had all guessed that that was at the bottom of it. "However," said Lady Bruton, anxious to leave the subject, "we shall hear the whole story from Peter himself." The coffee was very slow in coming. "The address," murmured Hugh Whitbread, and there was at once a ripple in the grey tide of service which washed round Lady Bruton day in, day out, collecting, intercepting, enveloping her in a fine tissue which broke concussions, mitigated interruptions, and spread round the house in Brook Street a fine net where things lodged and were picked out accurately, instantly, by grey-haired Perkins, who had been with Lady Bruton these 30 years, and now wrote down the address. Handed it to Mr. Whitbread, who took out his pocket-book, raised his eyebrows, and, slipping it in among documents of the highest importance, said that he would get Evelyn to ask him to lunch. They were waiting to bring the coffee until Mr. Whitbread had finished. Hugh was very slow, Lady Bruton thought. He was getting fat, she noticed. Richard always kept himself in the pink of condition. She was getting impatient. The whole of her being was setting positively, undeniably, domineeringly, brushing aside all this unnecessary trifling, Peter Walsh and his affairs, upon that subject which engaged her attention, and not merely her attention, but that fibre which was the ramrod of her soul, that essential part of her without which Millicent Bruton would not have been Millicent Bruton. That project for emigrating young people of both sexes, born of respectable parents, and setting them up with a fair prospect of doing well in Canada. She exaggerated. She had perhaps lost her sense of proportion. Emigration was not to others the obvious remedy, the sublime conception. It was not to them, not to Hugh or Richard or even to devoted Miss Brush, the liberator of the pent egotism, which a strong martial woman, well-nourished, well-descended, of direct impulses, downright feelings, and little introspective power, broad and simple, why could not everyone be broad and simple, she asked, feels rise within her once youth is past, and must eject upon some object. It may be emigration, it may be emancipation, but whatever it be, this object round which the essence of her soul is daily secreted becomes inevitably prismatic, lustrous, half looking glass, half precious stone. Now carefully hidden in case people should sneer at it, now proudly displayed. Emigration had become, in short, largely Lady Bruton. But she had to write. And one letter to the Times, she used to say to Miss Brush, cost her more than to organise an expedition to South Africa, which she had done in the war. After a morning's battle, beginning, tearing up, beginning again, she used to feel the futility of her own womanhood as she felt it on no other occasion, and would turn gratefully to the thought of Hugh Whitbread, who possessed, no one could doubt it, the art of writing letters to the Times. Since it was a very hot night, and the paper boys went by with placards proclaiming in huge red letters that there was a heat wave, wicker chairs were placed on the hotel steps. And there, sipping, smoking, detached, gentlemen sat. Peter Walsh sat there. One might fancy that day, the London day, was just beginning. Like a woman who had slipped off her print dress and white apron to array herself in blue and pearls, the day changed, put off stuff, took gauze, changed to evening. And with the same sigh of exhilaration that a woman breathes, tumbling petticoats on the floor, it too shed dust, heat, colour. The traffic thinned. Motor cars, tinkling, darting, succeeded the lumber of vans. And here and there, among the thick foliage of the squares, an intense light hung. "I resign," the evening seemed to say, as it paled and faded above the battlements and prominences, moulded, pointed, of hotel, flat, and block of shops. "I fade," she was beginning. "I disappear." But London would have none of it, and rushed her bayonets into the sky, pinioned her, constrained her to partnership in her revelry. For the great revolution of Mr. Willett's summertime had taken place since Peter Walsh's last visit to England. The prolonged evening was new to him. It was inspiriting, rather, for as the young people went by with their dispatch boxes, awfully glad to be free, proud, too, dumbly of stepping this famous pavement, joy of a kind, cheap, tinsely if you like, but all the same, rapture, flushed their faces. They dressed well, too. Pink stockings, pretty shoes. They would now have 2 hours at the pictures. It sharpened, it refined them, the yellow-blue evening light. And on the leaves in the square shone lurid, livid, they looked as if dipped in seawater, the foliage of a submerged city. He was astonished by the beauty. It was encouraging, too, for where the returned Anglo-Indian sat by rights, he knew crowds of them, in the Oriental Club, biliously summing up the ruin of the world. Here was he, as young as ever, envying young people their summertime and the rest of it, and more than suspecting from the words of a girl, from a housemaid's laughter, intangible things you couldn't lay your hands on, that shift in the whole pyramidal accumulation which in his youth had seemed immovable. On top of them it had pressed, weighed them down, the women especially, like those flowers Clarissa's Aunt Helena used to press between sheets of grey blotting paper with Littré's dictionary on top, sitting under the lamp after dinner. She was dead now. He had heard of her, from Clarissa, losing the sight of one eye. It seemed so fitting, one of nature's masterpieces, that old Miss Parry should turn to glass. She would die like some bird in a frost gripping her perch. She belonged to a different age, but being so entire, so complete, would always stand up on the horizon, stone-white, eminent, like a lighthouse marking some past stage on this adventurous, long, long voyage, this interminable... He felt for a copper to buy a paper and read about Surrey and Yorkshire. He had held out that copper millions of times. Surrey was all out once more. This interminable life. What Sally felt was simply this. She had owed Clarissa an enormous amount. They had been friends, not acquaintances, friends. And she still saw Clarissa all in white, going about the house with her hands full of flowers. To this day, tobacco plants made her think of Boughton. But did Peter understand? She lacked something. Lacked what was it? She had charm. She had extraordinary charm. But to be frank, and she felt that Peter was an old friend, a real friend, did absence matter? Did distance matter? She had often wanted to write to him, but torn it up, yet felt he understood, for people understand without things being said, as one realises, growing old, and old she was, had been that afternoon to see her sons at Eton, where they had the mumps. To be quite frank, then, how could Clarissa have done it? Married Richard Dalloway, a sportsman, a man who cared only for dogs. Literally, when he came into the room, he smelt of the stables. And then all this, she waved her hand. Hugh Whitbread it was, strolling past in his white waistcoat, dim, fat, blind, past everything he looked, except self-esteem and comfort. "He's not going to recognise us," said Sally. And really, she hadn't the courage. So that was Hugh, the admirable Hugh. "And what does he do?" she asked Peter. "He blacked the king's boots or counted bottles at Windsor," Peter told her. Peter kept his sharp tongue still. "But Sally must be frank," Peter said. "That kiss now, Hugh's." "On the lips," she assured him, in the smoking room one evening. She went straight to Clarissa in a rage. "Hugh didn't do such things," Clarissa said, "the admirable Hugh." Hugh's socks were, without exception, the most beautiful she had ever seen. And now his evening dress, perfect. "And had he children?" "Everybody in the room has 6 sons at Eton," Peter told her, "except himself. He, thank God, had none. No sons, no daughters, no wife." "Well, he didn't seem to mind," said Sally. He looked younger, she thought, than any of them. "But it had been a silly thing to do, in many ways," Peter said, "to marry like that." "A perfect goose she was," he said. "But," he said, "we had a splendid time of it." But how could that be, Sally wondered. What did he mean? And how odd it was to know him, and yet not know a single thing that had happened to him. And did he say it out of pride? Very likely, for after all, it must be galling for him, though he was an oddity, a sort of sprite, not at all an ordinary man. It must be lonely at his age to have no home, nowhere to go to. But he must stay with them for weeks and weeks. Of course he would. He would love to stay with them, and that was how it came out. All these years, the Dalloways had never been once. Time and time they had asked them. Clarissa, for it was Clarissa, of course, would not come. For, said Sally, Clarissa was at heart a snob. One had to admit it, a snob. And it was that that was between them, she was convinced. Clarissa thought she had married beneath her, her husband being, she was proud of it, a miner's son. Every penny they had, he had earned. As a little boy, her voice trembled, he had carried great sacks. And so she would go on, Peter felt, hour after hour. the miner's son. People thought she had married beneath her, her five sons. And what was the other thing? Plants, hydrangeas, syringas, very, very rare hibiscus lilies that never grow north of the Suez Canal. But she, with one gardener in a suburb near Manchester, had beds of them, positively beds. Now, all that Clarissa had escaped, unmaternal as she was. A snob, was she? Yes, in many ways. Where was she all this time? It was getting late. Yet, said Sally, when I heard Clarissa was giving a party, I felt I couldn't not come. Must see her again. And I'm staying in Victoria Street, practically next door. So I came without an invitation. But, she whispered, tell me, do. Who is this? The way to Regent's Park Tube Station. Could they tell her the way to Regent's Park Tube Station? Maisie Johnson wanted to know. She was only up from Edinburgh 2 days ago. Not this way, over there, Rezia exclaimed, waving her aside, lest she should see Septimus. Both seemed queer, Maisie Johnson thought. Everything seemed very queer. In London for the first time, come to take up a post at her uncle's in Leadenhall Street, and now walking through Regent's Park in the morning, this couple on the chairs gave her quite a turn. The young woman seeming foreign, the man looking queer. So that should she be very old, she would still remember and make it jangle again among her memories how she had walked through Regent's Park on a fine summer's morning 50 years ago. For she was only 19, and had got her way at last to come to London. And now how queer it was, this couple she had asked the way of. And the girl started and jerked her hand, and the man, he seemed awfully odd. Quarrelling, perhaps. Parting forever, perhaps. Something was up, she knew. And now all these people, for she returned to the Broadwalk, the stone basins, the prim flowers, the old men and women, invalids, most of them in bath chairs, all seemed, after Edinburgh, so queer. And Maisie Johnson, as she joined that gently trudging, vaguely gazing, breeze-kissed company, squirrels perching and preening, sparrow fountains fluttering for crumbs, dogs busy with the railings, busy with each other, while the soft, warm air washed over them and lent to the fixed, unsurprised gaze with which they received life something whimsical and mollified, Maisie Johnson positively felt she must cry, "Oh!" For that young man on the seat had given her quite a turn. Something was up, she knew. "Horror! Horror!" she wanted to cry. She had left her people. They had warned her what would happen. "Why hadn't she stayed at home?" she cried, twisting the knob of the iron railing. "That girl," thought Mrs. Dempster, who saved crusts for the squirrels and often ate her lunch in Regent's Park, "didn't know a thing yet. And really, it seemed to her better to be a little stout, a little slack, a little moderate in one's expectations." Percy drank. Well, better to have a son, thought Mrs. Dempster. She had had a hard time of it, and couldn't help smiling at a girl like that. "You'll get married, if you're pretty enough," thought Mrs. Dempster. "Get married," she thought, "and then you'll know. Oh, the cooks, and so on. Every man has his ways. But whether I'd have chosen quite like that if I could have known," thought Mrs. Dempster, and could not help wishing to whisper a word to Maisie Johnson, to feel on the creased pouch of her worn old face the kiss of pity. "For it's been a hard life," thought Mrs. Dempster. What hadn't she given to it? Roses, figure, her feet too. She drew the knobbed lumps beneath her skirt. "Roses," she thought sardonically. "All trash, my dear. For really, what with eating, drinking and mating, the bad days and good, life had been no mere matter of roses. And what was more, let me tell you, Carrie Dempster had no wish to change her lot with any woman's in Kentish Town. But," she implored, "pity. Pity for the loss of roses. Pity," she asked of Maisie Johnson, standing by the hyacinth beds. Straightening himself and stealthily fingering his pocket knife, he started after her, to follow this woman, this excitement, which seemed, even with its back turned, to shed on him a light which connected them, which singled him out, as if the random uproar of the traffic had whispered through hollowed hands his name. Not Peter, but his private name, which he called himself in his own thoughts. "You," she said, "only you," saying it with her white gloves and her shoulders. Then the thin long cloak, which the wind stirred as she walked past Dent's shop in Cockspur Street, blew out with an enveloping kindness, a mournful tenderness, as of arms that would open and take the tired. "But she's not married. She's young, quite young," thought Peter, the red carnation he had seen her wear as she came across Trafalgar Square, burning again in his eyes and making her lips red. But she waited at the curbstone. There was a dignity about her. She was not worldly, like Clarissa, not rich, like Clarissa. Was she, he wondered as she moved, respectable? Witty, with a lizard's flickering tongue, he thought, for one must invent, one must allow oneself a little diversion. A cool, waiting wit, a darting wit, not noisy. She moved, she crossed, he followed her. To embarrass her was the last thing he wished. Still, if she stopped, he would say, "Come and have an ice," he would say, and she would answer perfectly simply, "Oh, yes." But other people got between them in the street, obstructing him, blotting her out. He pursued. She changed. There was colour in her cheeks, mockery in her eyes. He was an adventurer, reckless, he thought, swift, daring, indeed, landed as he was last night from India, a romantic buccaneer, careless of all these damn proprieties, yellow dressing gowns, pipes, fishing rods in the shop windows, and respectability and evening parties and spruce old men wearing white slips beneath their waistcoats. He was a buccaneer. On and on she went, across Piccadilly and up Regent Street, ahead of him, her cloak, her gloves, her shoulders, combining with the fringes and the laces and the feather boas in the windows to make the spirit of finery and whimsy which dwindled out of the shops onto the pavement as the light of a lamp goes wavering at night over hedges in the darkness. Laughing and delightful, she had crossed Oxford Street and Great Portland Street and turned down one of the little streets, and now the great moment was approaching, for now she slackened, opened her bag, and with one look in his direction, but not at him, one look that bade farewell, summed up the whole situation and dismissed it triumphantly, forever, had fitted her key, opened the door, and gone. Clarissa's voice saying, "Remember my party, remember my party," sang in his ears. The house was one of those flat red houses with hanging flower baskets of vague impropriety. It was over. "Well, I've had my fun. I've had it," he thought, looking up at the swinging baskets of pale geraniums. And it was smashed to atoms, his fun, for it was half made up, as he knew very well, invented this escapade with the girl. Made up as one makes up the better part of life, he thought. Making oneself up, making her up, creating an exquisite amusement, and something more. But odd it was, and quite true. All this one could never share. It smashed to atoms. He turned, went up the street, thinking to find somewhere to sit, till it was time for Lincoln's Inn, for Messrs. Hooper and Greatley. Where should he go? No matter. Up the street, then, towards Regent's Park. His boots on the pavement struck out, no matter, for it was early, still very early. As the ancient song bubbled up opposite Regent's Park tube station, still the earth seemed green and flowery. Still, though it issued from so rude a mouth, a mere hole in the earth, muddy too, matted with root fibres and tangled grasses. Still the old bubbling, burbling song, soaking through the knotted roots of infinite ages and skeletons and treasure, streamed away in rivulets over the pavement and all along the Marylebone Road and down towards Euston, fertilizing, leaving a damp stain. Still remembering how once in some primeval May she had walked with her lover, this rusty pump, this battered old woman with one